Well, I was listening to a television preacher a day or so ago, and he said the word sanctuary means a place of peace and refuge and where you're isolated away from problems and so forth. And that's true, that the sanctuary was a place of refuge. In fact, we have the cities of refuge in the Bible. In a chapter in the book of Numbers. But that's not the primary meaning of the word sanctuary. The word sanctuary actually is not a Hebrew word. It's a Latin word. You probably have heard at one time or another, you've heard Catholic choirs sing the word sanctus, which means holy. So the real meaning of the word sanctuary is a holy place. And that is even more clear in the Hebrew language. Because in the Hebrew language, the word for sanctuary or temple or tabernacle was kodesh. Kodesh. And the word kodesh comes from the word to be holy. Kadash, to be holy. Kodesh, holy place. And sometimes they would put an M in front of that. Mikdash, that's another word for sanctuary, also means holy place. And so they alternated between these words, the Kodesh or the Mikdash, you see. So they alternated those words back and forth. So the primary meaning of the sanctuary is a holy place. And it is, of course, the presence of God that makes it holy. It's not man that makes it holy. Man sets it aside, and it's set aside for the particular use of God. And so we have the holy place. And of course, as you know, in the Bible, we're going to study the Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and so forth to see how the sanctuary was set up and how it was used and the laws that governed its use. The courtyard, even around the sanctuary, was to isolate it apart as a holy place. And then, of course, within the sanctuary or temple building itself, there was the holy place and the most holy place. So all of this is emphasis on the holiness of God as He is resident there in that sanctuary, in that temple, in that tabernacle. And, of course, this was manifested by His visible presence, the sign, I should say, of His visible presence, which was known as the Shekinah glory. And I want to introduce to the class my wife, Karen, who was kind enough to help me when I had a little fainting spell. And I want to introduce to you other members of the Shea family. We have Jack Shea and Kathy Shea right here. And they came up and introduced me to themselves. And the reason why that's so unusual is because the name Shea is Irish. And as the joke goes, the Irish are more Catholic than the Pope. And the only other Shays I have known were Catholics. And so it's a real pleasure to have members of the branch that found the truth. And they told me they came out of Methodism. And I had an experience with a Methodist pastor in my hometown in Ontario, California. He was a friend of mine. The Methodist church was only a block away from my house. So I used to stop and chat with him on the street. I asked him one time about why they didn't keep the Bible Sabbath. And he said, well, the government gives us a day to keep, so we keep it. So that was his answer as to why they kept Sunday. Now, my wife's family were Methodists also, a rather distinguished family in Adventism. The family name is Olson. And I'll tell you a little story about the Olsons. There were two Olson brothers who immigrated from Norway, and they settled in a little town of Oakland, Wisconsin. And this is about the time of the Civil War. And they were Methodists. Now that, to the family, is a little bit strange because we had assumed coming from Norway they would be Lutherans. And we don't know how they got from Lutheranism to Methodism, but apparently they said that the Methodists were a little more lively, and they liked a lively church. So that seemed to be their motivation for moving over there. Well, these two brothers got adjoining farms, and the way it used to work, the pattern in the farms was, you would once you got the harvest in the fall, you would kind of sit by the pot-bellied stove all winter long and read. And so they got the idea that they would read the Bible through in the winter, and they were both going to, they had the same assignment. And they said, well, let's study through the Bible and see what it says about worshiping on Saturday or Sunday. And so these two brothers on these adjoining farms during the winter, they both read their Bibles through, and at spring when they got ready to go out and do the planting, plowing and the planting, they compared notes. And they said, one brother said, well, I didn't find anything in there about worshiping on Sunday. It says they're supposed to worship on the Sabbath. And the other brother says, I didn't find anything in there about worshiping on Sunday. It says we're supposed to worship on the Sabbath. And so these two brothers, the next Sunday, they went to the Methodist church. It was a small church, 25, 30 members, you know, mostly family relatives or a few more like that. And they got up in front and said, you know, we have studied this through and we find no biblical basis for worshiping on Sunday. We believe we should worship on Saturday, which is the biblical Sabbath. And the whole congregation said, we're with you. And so for 2 years, there was a Seventh-day Methodist church in Oakland, Wisconsin. Now then, one of the veteran Norwegian missionaries came by. What is his name, dear? Do you remember? Madison. Elder Madison came by. And he found this little town that had these Seventh-day Sabbath keepers. So he held some meetings, and by the time he got through, they were no longer Seventh-day Methodists, they were Seventh-day Adventists. Now that little church still exists and still functions. So it's 130 years at least that church has been going. And that church is still small, probably only has about as many members as we have here today. But it has given 35 workers to the Adventist denomination. And one of those workers was my wife's great-great-grandfather, whose name was O.A. Olson. And you might recognize that name as the General Conference President from 1888 to 1901 was when he was President of the General Conference. Now, there's an interesting story about how he became President of the General Conference, because 1888, as you may remember, was a very famous year in Adventist history, because all the brethren were in Minneapolis fighting with each other, you know. But Brother Olson wasn't there. He was off in Denmark holding evangelistic meetings. So he was what they call a compromise candidate. Because he wasn't there, they said, well, let's put Brother Olson in. So that's how he got to be General Conference President. A little bit about the 1888 General Conference. We're just kind of rambling a little bit here. Tempers were very frayed because of the pre-meeting. See, for a general conference, we have a pre-session, which is studies for ministers and so forth, ministers and workers, and then there's the regular general conference. In the pre-session for 1888, one of the issues they were studying was the identity of the 10 horns on the beast in Daniel. And they agreed on 9 of the horns, but they didn't agree on which tribe would represent the German horn. And some said it was the Alemanni, and some said it was the Huns. And this was a major point of friction. So the brethren were going around the campgrounds, and they would say, are you a Hun or an Alemanni? Are you a Hun or an Alemanni? So you see, they were so busy arguing about this, by the time they came to hear the message of righteousness by faith, that their tempers were frayed, and they couldn't fully take hold of it. But that's the story of my wife's great-great-grandfather and how he just became an accidental pope or an accidental general conference president. You know, John the 23rd for the Catholic Church was a compromise candidate. You know, they couldn't agree, and so they figured, well, let's take this old man and he can't do much harm before he passes off the scene of action. Well, whether you want to evaluate him as doing a lot of harm or a lot of good, he brought the new Vatican Council, and so he turned out to be, although he was just a compromise candidate and they thought he'd be a timekeeper, time marker, he actually did quite a bit to renovate or update the Catholic Church. Well, the topic is the sanctuary. We must get back to the sanctuary. But since I am on the subject of Catholic relatives, last Sabbath afternoon I was watching 3ABN, and the program on there was a little boring, so I switched to the Catholic channel. Actually, I have Sky Angel, or used to have Sky Angel, and they have about 10 channels of Protestant stuff, and some of them are good and some of them are not so good. So I happened to click on the Catholic channel, and they were showing a meeting from the Polish Catholic Church in Chicago. And I was shocked. I have never seen anything quite like it. Now, I'll give you a little of my background. I spent 3 years in the country of Nicaragua. And Nicaragua, if you want to call it, they have a little more primitive brand of Catholicism down there. For example, at Easter time, they take the two images in the church, and on Friday, Jesus goes, they take the image out in procession, and they go one way around the town. And on Saturday, they take the image of Mary and they go the other way around the town. And on Easter Sunday, they take both images out in procession and they circle around the town and meet in the middle of the town square. So I'm accustomed to that kind of Catholicism. But what I saw in this Polish church really shocked me. They have a model, a good oversized model, of exactly what we're going to be talking about here, the Ark of the Covenant. They have a, the Ark of the Covenant was actually a rather small box, as we will read about it. But this one, they made an oversized box, and it was gilt with gold. And it's clear that it was meant to be a representation of the Ark of the Covenant, because it had the poles on the rings and the poles on the side. And it even had an outline of the Ten Commandments, given the Catholic way, three commandments and seven commandments. But up above the mercy seat, they had Mary. And I said, boy, that's a shocker. You know, where the Shekinah glory would rest in the Old Testament times, they put Mary. I couldn't believe it. But anyway, that's what they wanted to do, so that's what they did. All right, now, to give you a very brief outline of where we're going, today we're going to go through Exodus, maybe part of Leviticus and part of Numbers. Exodus is the construction of the tabernacle and the equipment that went in it. And so we call that the form of the sanctuary. So Exodus from chapter 25 to 40, the form of the sanctuary. Leviticus is the function of the sanctuary. How they used it, the sacrifices, the offerings, and the ministry of the daily ministry and the yearly ministry that's so important to us as Adventists. So Exodus 25 to 40 is the form of the sanctuary. Leviticus is the function of the sanctuary. And the book of Numbers is the use of the sanctuary. Now, when we talk about the use of the sanctuary, we mean, first of all, it gives the instructions about how they were to pick up the sanctuary. There were three groups of priestly families, the Kohathites and the Gershonites and the Merarites, and how they moved, it was a portable shrine. And they moved it with them the whole 40 years they traveled in the wilderness, and they brought it into the promised land and finally set it up at a place called Shiloh. We'll look at that in the book of Joshua. And so you have the form of the sanctuary in Exodus, the function of the sanctuary in Leviticus, and the use of the sanctuary in the book of Numbers. And the book of Numbers has a number of cases of judgment. And it's interesting, these are what we might call mini judgments. And usually there was investigation. The individual or whoever was involved and whatever the problem was were brought to the door of the sanctuary. And God, not Moses, passed the sentence. So you see the tabernacle in the wilderness was also used for judgment. And they weren't all negative judgments. Some of them were positive judgments, and we'll look at those. So, form of the sanctuary, Exodus. Function of the sanctuary, Leviticus. use of the sanctuary numbers. And that's probably as far as we'll get today. So let's go to a famous verse that you all know so well. And if I say Exodus 25:8, how many here can recite Exodus 25:8? It's the second text that an Adventist ought to know. First text, Daniel 8:14. Second text, Exodus 25:8. Let them build me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. Okay, so the holy presence of God, what we talked about, the sanctuary means a holy place. And it's holy not because of what man does there, but because of what God does there. His presence and his visible token of his presence was man. Can we help you? Are you looking for somebody? Is this man's wife here? Apparently not yet. All right, Exodus 25:8, now a verse that goes right with it that may not be quite so well known is he gives the instruction about how it's supposed to be built. So if you have your Bibles with you, it'll be helpful if you bring your Bibles. According to all that I am going to show you, as the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern for all its furniture, just so you shall construct it. Now that word pattern is very interesting. It comes from the word to build. The word to build in Hebrew. You're going to learn four or five words of Hebrew today. And the word to build in Hebrew is bana, to build. This word is tabnit. So that's the word bana, and they put a T in front of it. Now the T with Hebrew verbs means reciprocal action, action that goes back and forth. So the word we translate pattern means something that is built according to something else. So you go back and forth from the plan to the construction. To the plan, to the construction. That's the meaning of this word pattern. Now, liberal scholars say, well, the Israelites just got the idea for this tabernacle and the temple from the Phoenicians or the Canaanites. But that's not true. That's not what the text says. And you can actually demonstrate that archaeologically. God gave the dimensions and the instructions of how to build the sanctuary. And the interesting thing is, archaeologists have dug up now in Syria and Palestine about 50 temples. And you can usually tell whether it's a temple. You know, you won't find the building, you'll find the stumps of the walls. And you'll find the stumps of the walls, and you'll find a holy place and a most holy place. And sometimes they build it in a rectangular way or in a broad way or a round way. They had different ways they could do this. But it's pretty obvious when you have a temple, and especially the pagans would put an altar not out in the courtyard but in the most holy place, because that was a platform on which the statue of the god sat. And that's one thing you don't have in the Hebrew tabernacle or temple. There's an interesting story, we may get to it, but I'll tell it to you now. When the Roman general Pompey came to Jerusalem in 60 BC, when the Romans conquered Judea, he wanted to see what the God of the Israelites looked like. So he marched into the temple. Now, of course, the priests were standing there protesting, please don't, you'll contaminate, you'll defile our temple, but, you know, to the victor belong the spoils. So he marched in, and what do you think he found? Nothing. An empty room. The most holy place was an empty room, because the Ark of the Covenant was so holy that it was hidden as Nebuchadnezzar's troops approached, and apparently they lost a knowledge of where it was hidden over the 70 years that they were in Babylonian captivity. So when they came back and rebuilt the temple, the second temple, they rebuilt all of the equipment that we're going to read about here. That was gone, but they rebuilt it. They had new ones. New altar of incense, new lampstands, new table of showbread, and so forth. But they didn't rebuild or build a new Ark of the Covenant. That was so holy and such strong traditions back to Moses, they didn't replace it. They left the space open. And so here is this Roman general marches in there. He wants to see what the statue of the Israelite God looked like. Nothing. Empty. So that shows you the difference between the Canaanites and the Israelites. But even when you... thank you. I have some water, but I appreciate you bringing some. Yes. Thank you very much. If you look at the measurements, if you look at the measurements of these pagan temples, the interesting thing is none of those pagan temples line up with the measurements for Solomon's temple or the tabernacle in the wilderness. Now there's one in Syria at a place called Tel Tayanit that comes the closest to Solomon's temple. But the interesting thing is Solomon's temple was built in the 10th century B.C. and this temple, which comes the closest of the pagan temples like it, was built in the 9th century B.C. So if there was any copying being done, the pagans copied Solomon. Solomon didn't copy the pagans. So we have it right here. And in addition, we notice where Solomon got, since we're a little bit off on the topic here, where Solomon got his measurements from. Just as the Lord gave Moses the measurements for the tabernacle, he gave the measurements for the temple to David for Solomon to build. And Solomon did build it. You remember the story, 2 Samuel 7. David says to the Lord, "Well, I'm dwelling in a palace, but you don't have a house to dwell in. So I, David, want to build a house for you, God." And God says, "No, you're not going to build a temple for me because you're a man of blood. Your son will build the temple. But I will build a house for you." There's a play on words there. And the house that he was going to build for David was a dynastic house, a house of descendants. And so that indeed worked out. You know, the Lord said there'd be a descendant of David on the throne of Israel forever. Now, it didn't last forever, but it did last for 400 years. Every king on the throne of Judah was a lineal descendant of David, every one of them. Now, that's not true in the north. When the north broke away, you read about the assassinations and a new line of kings, an assassination and a new line of kings, assassination and a new line of kings, and so forth. So there were several dynasties in the north. But in the south, only one line of dynastic kings. All right, back to the tabernacle. Building the tabernacle. They're at the foot of Mount Sinai. The covenant with God has been made. The Ten Commandments have been given. The auxiliary laws have been given. And now it's time to, first of all, build a place for the Ark of the Covenant. Exodus 25, verse 10. The first thing that God gave instructions about building was the Ark of the Covenant. "They shall construct an ark of acacia wood, 2.5 cubits long." Remember, cubit is about 1.5 feet. And so if it's 2.5 cubits long, that's about 4 feet. Something like that. Not very big. And what it is, basically, it's a box. And it's a box with the purpose of containing something. And so what does it contain? Verse 16, "You shall put into the ark the testimony." Please notice carefully that word testimony. What is the testimony here? Ten Commandments. I want you to notice some of these other references to the testimony. Look at verse 21. "You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony which I will give you." And then the next verse, "There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony," there it is again, "I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandment for the sons of Israel. Now, the reason why that word testimony is important is it illuminates some other verses in the Bible. I am mildly amused when I hear an evangelist preaching on Isaiah 8:20. It says, according to the law and the testimony, there is no light in them, you know, the spirits that peep and mutter, you know, the spiritualistic stuff. And so we often say, well, according to the law, that's the Ten Commandments, and the testimony, that's whatever goes along with it. It's actually the other way around. The law is the Torah. And the Torah, if you ask a Jew today, what's the Torah? He knows very well. It's the five books of Moses. And the word Torah comes from the word Yerah, there's another Hebrew word for you, which means to teach. So the Torah is the teaching. So it's the teaching, the books of Moses, and the testimony. There it is. So the testimony in Isaiah 8:20, the things have to line up with, are the Ten Commandments. So it's according to the Torah, the books of Moses, and the most specific part of the books of Moses, the testimony, the Ten Commandments. Now, why is that important? When we come to the New Testament, I want you to notice, I hope by Friday we'll get to the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 15. Having looked at these testimony texts, Revelation chapter 15, another one of these sanctuary scenes set in the heavenly sanctuary. And it says that the locus of the action there, as probation closes, and they're getting ready to send the seven last plagues, Revelation chapter 15, verse 8, and after these things I looked, and the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was open. What is that testimony? Now you know from Exodus, it's the Ten Commandments. You see, you had the temple, the heavenly temple. And in it, there's the tabernacle, which is the most, let's call it the most holy place. And in that was the testimony, which is the Ten Commandments. This is what Ellen White refers to as the great heavenly original. The great heavenly original. And it's the same with the Ark of the Covenant. Remember, this is made from a heavenly pattern too. And there's the great heavenly original, and there's the earthly copy. And the earthly copy was what was hidden in a cave somewhere around Jerusalem. And I might as well answer the question of where it is. Don't I wish I knew? I used to, in a talk when that question would come up, I had seven or eight different possibilities of places where people have said they think the Ark of the Covenant is. I recently got an article in a journal, and this guy had a list of 20 different places where people think the Ark of the Covenant is. So I don't know where the Ark of the Covenant is. And what Ellen White says is this. Prophets and kings, she says, Jeremiah and the priests hid the Ark of the Covenant in a cave as the Babylonian troops were approaching. In that passage in Prophets and Kings, she doesn't say that it will be found again. But she does say it still is where it was hidden. That's all. Doesn't say where, doesn't say if it will be found again. That's all. Just, it was hidden in a cave, and there it still is. Now, there is, in her writings, and you can get this from the Ellen G. White Estate, they have a little 3 or 4 page paper, Will the Ark of the Covenant Be Found? There is a statement or two which sounds like she doesn't really talk about the Ark of the Covenant. She talks about the tables of the law. Will the Ten Commandments be found? She's not so interested in the Ark of the Covenant. And she talks about them being manifested to the human race before Christ comes. Now, the question is what that means. If you go to the book Great Controversy, you may remember the passage in which the Ten Commandments will be shown in the sky as Christ comes. And so the question about this reference is that what she is referring to, or is she talking about the finding of the actual tables of the law? I don't know. I'll leave that up to you to decide. But as I say, her focus is not so much on the Ark of the Covenant as it is on the tables of the law, because it's God's law, which is especially broken at this time, and which especially needs the repairer of the breach to bring the human race back to obedience of. So I'll leave that with you, and that's as much as I can say about the finding in the Ark of the Covenant. But we have the story of the building of the Ark of the Covenant. As you know, it was to be gilt with gold. They had gold foil. The gold would be hammered out into a very fine sheet and wrapped around this. And it had the two poles for carrying it and the cherubim above it. And so that was the first object of the instruction about constructing objects to go in the sanctuary. And the second one is the table of showbread, and that's in Exodus 25, verse 23. You shall make a table of acacia wood, 2 cubits long and 1 cubit wide. So it's 1.5 feet wide and three feet long. So it's not big. It's a fairly small object. And it tells about how they're to make it and so on and so forth. And verse 30 is its use. You shall set the bread of the presence on the table before me at all times. Now, what does the bread represent? Well, it actually has a twofold representation. How many loaves of bread did they put on the table of showbread? 12. What do those 12 loaves represent? 12 tribes of Israel. So we are the tribes of Israel. We're an offering to God. But the bread is also a symbol for what else? Christ. Anybody remember where he preached the bread of life sermon? That's the $64,000 question. John chapter 6. John chapter 6. Now, Jesus was on the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he feeds the 5,000. And they think, this is terrific. This is wonderful. We need to make this guy king. Because when our troops go out and fight the Romans and they get wounded, he can heal them on the spot. And then when they need food, he can just provide them with the food right there. This is the guy we should make king. Jesus, of course, will have none of it. He sends his disciples away in a boat. He sends the people away. He goes up into the mountain to pray, and then he comes walking on the water to the boat as they cross the Sea of Galilee. So they get to the other side. They come back to Capernaum, the place where Peter's home, Peter's mother-in-law lived. And if you go there today, they have a pentagonal house, which they say there are some archaeological arguments for through tradition belonging to the family of Peter. I don't know. I've never studied that very carefully. I'm a little dubious. You know, you need to be careful about traditional places. You know, we get a lot of these traditional places from the Emperor Constantine. When he converted to Christianity in the 4th century, early 4th century, he and his mother, Queen Helena, went to the Holy Land, and they went around asking, where did this happen? Where did this happen? Where did this happen? And they kept saying, well, it happened here, it happened here, it happened here. And he would say, build a church here, build a church here, build a church here. And so you are relying upon the memory of people in the 4th century A.D. for those holy places. Now, some of them are obviously correct. The church that is built over the pool of Sychar, where Jesus asked water of the Samaritan woman, that's obviously accurate. Because it's the only place there's a well or a spring like that. But just to illustrate the point, there are 4 different gardens of Gethsemane. Now, they're all on the same slope of the mountain, but the churches have carved up the Mount of Olives, and one garden belongs to the Catholics. They seem to have the oldest trees. And then there's the Greek Orthodox garden, the Russian Orthodox garden, and I think the other one's Armenian. I'm not sure. So, you know, you can pay your money and take your chances which one you want. And so that's traditional places are a problem. But There are genuine traditional places that are accurate, and there are others that are obviously spurious. Now, what happened in the history of Christianity is Constantine had a wave of churches built, and then 2 centuries later, Justinian, the emperor, who saw himself as a great theologian, he wanted these churches rebuilt. So you get another wave of Christian church building. Many of those churches have been destroyed either by earthquakes or by war. The oldest one is the church in Bethlehem, and there's an interesting story about that. A Persian conqueror, his name was Khosroes II, came to Palestine in 606 AD, and he hated Christianity and Christian churches, so he gave the orders, tear them all down, burn them all down. But when his emissaries came to the church in Bethlehem, and they went inside the church, the Christians there had painted murals of the three wise men dressed in Persian garb. And so when Khosroes heard this, he said, well, save that one church because they've got Persian-style garments on the three wise men that are painted on the wall. So the church at Bethlehem survived. So that is, it's been damaged from time to time, but basically it still stands. And it's a very famous place in Christianity, of course. There used to be a great New Year's Christmas Eve celebration there, but that has been dampened because of the fence. There's a fence built between Bethlehem and Jerusalem now, and it encircles the city of Bethlehem and extends on the West Bank. So it's very difficult for pilgrims to go through that gate and so forth. So that church survived. That's the oldest church in Christianity. And it comes from 325 AD. And that one has a pretty good argument for it. Speaking of places that have traditions, because the place that you will go down into is the remnants of a cave. And in biblical times, and even today, the Palestinians, especially the Bedouin, will keep their livestock in caves underneath their houses. And so the idea, you know, since Jesus was born laid in a manger, you know, where animals ate from, and there wasn't any room in the inn for them, and they had to make second best. The idea that they would use a cave where animals were sheltered in the wintertime or other times of the year is possible. And Ellen White talks about Mary and Joseph traveling the length of the street in Bethlehem to its end. And that's where that cave is found, at the end of the street. So there's a plausible argument. On the contrary, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre has very weak arguments in favor of it. So, you know, again, it's a case of you pay your money and you take your choice when you look at these traditional sites. All right, so we have the bread. And the bread represents our gift to God. Incidentally, when was the bread changed? Every Sabbath morning, that's right. And the bread represents the bread of life which Jesus gave of himself. And so when he preaches the bread of life sermon in the synagogue in Capernaum, he says to the people, look, it's not the bread which I gave you yesterday over on the other side of the sea that's so important. It's not even the manna which God gave your fathers in the wilderness for 40 years that's so important. What's important is I am the bread of life. I have come down from heaven. And he who eats and partakes of this bread will live forever. I'm the bread of life. And so at first they said, well, Lord, give us ever more of this bread. But then he made it, you know, then they began to wonder, well, wait a minute. This guy's just a carpenter from Nazareth. What's he talking about? You know, we know his family. And so they began to draw back. Now you would say, you know, pastors are supposed to read their audiences, you know. And so when you're getting stiff opposition from the audience, you ought to soften the message, right? Well, Jesus didn't soften the message. He says, he who eats my blood and drinks my flesh will have everlasting life. And boil up in him, you know, and so forth. So they thought, this is really weird. And of course the Romans accused the Christians of being cannibals because of this saying of Jesus. And so so pastors are supposed to read their audience, and there's the cute story, it's apocryphal, I'm sure, about the young man who had just come out of seminary. And in the homiletics course, they told him that, look, when you're preaching a sermon and you get stuck, go back to the same text and say it louder. So he was preaching away, and he came to this text, "Behold, I come quickly." And then his mind went blank. And he thought, well, they told me in homiletic class, "Behold, I come quickly." So he said it again, louder, "Behold, I come quickly." And still nothing came. The rest of his sermon was a blank. So he said it a third time and pounded the pulpit, "Behold, I come quickly." And he got so off balance, he fell off the pulpit, and he fell into the lap of a lady on the front row. And he looks up, and he's very apologetic. He said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." She said, "That's all right, sonny. You said you were coming quickly." So the pastors have to read their audience. All right. We have the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy place. We have the Table of Showbread. Now, the next object built is the lamps. And we call this the menorah. And the menorah, you may recall from its description of its construction here, was a one stem with seven branches. Now, when we come to the book of Revelation, I often hear the translation candlesticks, the seven candlesticks of the church. That's not correct. They are lampstands. Lampstands, not candlesticks. And the lamp, there was a lamp. You probably have seen photographs, and you may even have seen drawings or photographs of the progression of how they developed lamps. The lamps originally started out as a simple cup. Then they began to put a rim around it. Then they put a spout on it. And then eventually by Roman times, they had covered it over. And by Byzantine times in the 5th century, they were writing on it, "Jesus is the light of the world." Beautiful little lamps. Jesus is the light of the world. Now, what were those lamps for? What did they hold? What did they put in it?
Oil.
And the oil was not diesel. It was olive oil. And we're now being told that biofuels is the way to go. Well, they already had them 2,000 years ago. So the seven-branch candlestick is really the seven-branched lampstand to hold seven lamps. Now, what did that represent in Old Testament terms? The oil in the lamps represents what? The Holy Spirit. Okay. Where do we get that? What biblical book? Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 4. The message to Zerubbabel the governor. You know, they had been back. They had been back from captivity for 15 or 20 years, and they still hadn't built the temple. And so the Lord sends the prophets Haggai and Zechariah to get these people stirred up to build the temple. And he gives a message to Joshua the high priest, and he gives a message to Zerubbabel the governor. And they are supposed to cooperate and get the building built, and then Joshua is supposed to minister in it. And the message to Zerubbabel is prefaced with a vision about two olive trees and the two golden pipes and the golden bowl with the lamps around the bowl and the 49 or 50 lips on those lamps. And the oil runs out of the olive trees into the great bowl and supplies the lamp. And then God says, Zechariah 4:6, that's the third verse that every Adventist ought to know. "Not by might, nor by power, but by my Spirit, says the Lord." Zerubbabel, you're not going to build this temple just because you're such a smart guy. You're not going to build this temple just because you're such a good engineer. You're not going to build this temple just because you're such a good labor organizer. It's the Holy Spirit that is going to enable you to accomplish what you didn't accomplish when you were trying to do it on your own strength and your own power 15 years ago. And so the oil, not by might nor by power, but by my Spirit, represents the oil that runs out of those olive trees into the great golden bowl and into the lamps. And so the menorah represents the oil of the Holy Spirit. But it also represents something more, doesn't it? What more does the oil or the light of the lamps represent? The church, yeah. In the book of Revelation, we have the churches. Before that, though, Christ. Christ. The light of the world. And at the Feast of Tabernacles, in the Gospel of John, John chapter 7, he preaches at the Feast of Tabernacles. And part of the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles was the four great candelabras that they set up in the court of the women. And these great candelabras would shed light over the city at night. And that light was to represent or symbolize or be a memorial of the light in the wilderness. You remember the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire? So, question. When did the priest know when to offer the daily sacrifice, the morning and evening sacrifice? During the wilderness wanderings. Well, you might say, well, he had to go out of his tent and he had to sight for the sun when it's touching the horizon and or when it's just coming up above the horizon. He didn't need to bother with that. All he had to do was look over the tabernacle, right? And when the pillar of cloud changed to the pillar of fire, it was time to offer the burnt offering. When the pillar of fire changed back to the pillar of cloud, it was time to offer the burnt offering. God himself signified the time for the daily offering in the sanctuary. So we can call those sanctuary days, if you please. And Numbers chapter 9 tells us about how the cloud led the people in the wilderness. And it talks about it in very interesting terms. It says, not from morning to evening, but from evening to morning. Evening to morning, sanctuary days. All right, so we have the... Now the next... In the book of Exodus, then, we have the Ark of the Covenant, we have the Table of Showbread, we have the lampstand, and then it goes into a description of how to build the tabernacle, the hangings for the tabernacle, and so forth. So chapter 26 is the description of the hangings for the tabernacle. And then when we come to chapter 27, we have the altar, but this is the altar of burnt offering. And this, as you know, was in the courtyard. And so here's a portable altar. You see, every time they moved the sanctuary, they didn't have to get another pile of stones together for another altar. They had this portable altar that they offered the sacrifice on. And it talks about the horns on the altar and what to do with the removing the ashes and have the rings on the corner for carrying it and so forth. And then the rest of chapter 27 is the courtyard and the wooden pillars around the courtyard and the hangings there. And then you'll notice at the end of chapter 27, it's kind of a summary verse, chapter 27, verses 20 and 21. You shall charge the sons of Israel that they bring your clear oil of beaten olives for the light, to make the lamp burn continually. Another Hebrew word for you, tamid. Tamid, daily or continually. In the tent of meeting, outside the veil. All right, we're not in the holy place, which is behind the veil. We're outside the veil, which is before the testimony. And you now know that the testimony is the Ten Commandments in the Ark of the Covenant. Aaron and his sons shall keep it in order from evening to morning before the Lord. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout all your generations for the sons of Israel. And then the final piece of, then there's the description of the garments for the priest. That's chapter 28. And his turban is the last part. And then you have the rite for the anointing of the priest in chapter 29. And finally we come to chapter 30. Moreover, you shall make an altar as a place for burning incense. You shall make it of acacia wood. That's what they're using for all of this. Length shall be a cubit, its width a cubit. That's pretty small, a foot and a half square. Height shall be 2 cubits, its horns, like the altar in the courtyard. It has 4 horns. You shall overlay it with pure gold. That's verse 3. And the gold rings for carrying it in verse 4. And the poles to carry it with in verse 5. And then its location. You shall put this altar in front of the veil that is near the Ark of the Testimony. All right, there's the testimony again. Is there any doubt that the testimony in the book of Exodus is the Ten Commandments? In front of the mercy seat that is over the Ark of the Testimony, where I will meet with you. And so verse 7 and 8 has to do with the daily actions of the priest, burning fragrant incense in verse 7, trimming the lamps at twilight in verse 8, and so forth. So if we go back to chapter 27, verse 20, you have the burning of the lamps continually, tamid, daily. Tamid is an adverb which modifies an action. And the action is, that word is used with all three of the actions in the holy place. The lamps were to be tended, trim the wicks, put in new oil, and so forth. Tamid, or daily, or continually. See, this word means something that goes on and on and on and on without interruption. And he burns incense on that altar, tamid, or continually. Every morning and every evening, when he went into the holy place and he tended the lamps, he also burned incense. And then it also says in Leviticus chapter 24 that the changing of the bread every Sabbath is tamid, or continual, before the Lord. Very interesting. Here's a case. It wasn't every day. The bread was always there, but it was always changed every Sabbath. So this is a continual action. Every Sabbath of the year, continually, went on and on and on. And so when we think about ministry in the sanctuary, what we have here is the daily ministry. The priest would burn the burnt offering in the courtyard. Then he would go into the holy place, and he would tend to the lamps, tend to the incense. And he would burn in the evening, he would burn the burnt offering, he would go in and tend to the lamps and tend to the incense. Every day without fail, even on the Day of Atonement. On the Day of Atonement, they also did the daily before they did the yearly. And after the yearly was finished, they did the daily again. So they had the morning and evening offering, but included, or like an envelope within that, is the Day of Atonement service. Now, 2 points from the New Testament. If you look for a moment at Hebrews 9, this has puzzled people sometimes. It gives a description of the sanctuary. In fact, this is a good summary for us of what we've been talking about here. If I can ever find Hebrews, here we are. I think we had this in our Sabbath school lesson, didn't we? Hebrews chapter 9. Now, even the first covenant, that is the old covenant with Moses and so forth, had regulations for divine worship in an earthly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle, it means a place prepared, the outer one, okay, that's the holy place, in which were the lampstand and the table for the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. It's Hebrews 9:2. Behind the second veil, there was a tabernacle or a room or a holy place which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense, and the Ark of the Covenant, covered on all sides with gold, in which was the golden jar holding the manna, Aaron's rod which budded, and the tables of the covenant. There's the Ten Commandments, or the testimony in the Ark. Now, people have been puzzled by the fact that they think that the writer of Hebrews was so ignorant that he got the Ark, altar of incense in the most holy place. That is not what it says. It doesn't use the preposition in. It says, having. Greek word, you don't need to know it, ekousin, having. The most holy place has the altar of incense. That is to say, its function is related to the most holy place. It's actually physically located in the holy place. But when you burn the incense on the altar, the purpose of burning the incense on the altar was so that the incense would go up over the veil and into the most holy place, into the presence of God. So the light was in the holy place, the bread was in the holy place, but the incense from the altar went into the most holy place. So it has a function in relationship to the most holy place. It doesn't say it was in it. You see, so people who think the writer of Hebrews was rather ignorant about where things were in the sanctuary just don't understand. He knows this sanctuary an awful lot better than we do. And he said it a particular way because he wanted to express a particular point. Now, what does that represent? Altar of incense. Prayers of the saints going up. Right. And we get that from Revelation chapter 8. Revelation chapter 8. Verses 2-5. And first it shows the seven angels that were given the seven trumpets. And then verse 3. Another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him, so that he might add it to the prayers of the saints on the golden altar which is before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand. So the incense, the sweet-smelling savor, represents the merits of Jesus are added to our prayers. I'll close. This clock has not yet been set on daylight saving time, right? Is it 5 o'clock? Almost 5 o'clock? Okay. I'll close with a story about a young man who didn't know how to pray. This story comes from the city of Lvov in Russia. And Jim Zachary, who used to work at the General Conference, told me this story. And he was holding meetings in Lvov. And there was an airline pilot, flew for the Russian Airlines. He didn't fly international flights. He flew domestic flights to other parts of Russia. And he was attending these meetings. And this is about 4 to 5 years ago now. And it was a time of drought. And the farmers were very worried about their crops. And so they made this known to Brother Zachary. So he prayed. And lo and behold, that night it rained. And this pilot was really impressed. He says, "My word, the man prays and it rains." So he went to the office. And he went to the office and says, I don't want to take my flights for the next 2 weeks. And the officer says, "Well, you have to take your flights. You can't get out of that. If you want to be employed by the airlines, you have to take your flights." So he was a little depressed and a little discouraged because he wanted those 2 weeks to attend the meetings. That's when the meetings finished, 2 weeks finished. So almost nightly meetings. So he went home. And for the first, remember, everybody in Russia is educated as atheists. He's never prayed in his life. He doesn't know how to pray. But he gets down on his knees and he says, "Oh God, whoever you are, wherever you are, if you can hear me, help me. Work it out so that I can go to these meetings." Later that afternoon, he goes to his mailbox. and in his mailbox is a summons to jury duty. Now, Russians have jury duty just like we have jury duty here. So he takes the letter from the court to his boss. And he says, what do I do about this? And the boss looks at him and he says, well, you have to go to court. That's the law. You have to go to court. And the expiration date on his jury duty was 2 weeks later. So he attended all the meetings. Now, when Brother Zachary told me this story, I said, well, whatever happened to him? Was he baptized? They baptized 600 people in that evangelistic meeting. And he said, you know, I'm not sure that I don't know whether he was baptized or not. Now, a couple of years later, I was teaching at Zaolksky in Russia, and some of the students we had were converts from that meeting in Lvov. And I asked him, do you know this guy, this pilot? And they said, yes, we know him. And I said, was he baptized at the end of the meeting? And they said, yes, he was baptized. So here's a guy, he doesn't know who he's praying to, he doesn't know how to pray, he doesn't know what to say, but the incense from the altar with the merits of Jesus go up with his prayer. Well, we've got the tabernacle laid out, and so tomorrow we'll look at the book of Leviticus and see how it functions. So you can keep in mind as you, in your night dreams, with your visions and dreams, you can look at the altar of incense, and you can look at the table of showbread, and you can look at the Ark of the Covenant, and you can look at the lampstands, the menorah, as the Lord focuses our attention upward. Okay, God bless you, and have a good rest of the day and a good rest of the camp meeting.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.